for those at the back?
No.
No. All right, that's good news. Good morning. It's a lovely morning, and I just, when we were caught in the storm yesterday, and that terrible hail bigger than golf balls, I was just thinking, why weren't you getting that deluge? Because it really was so much rain. It would have done you a lot of good here in the Western Cape. Nevertheless, we got it, and hope that the Western Cape also gets rain soon. Truly, we must. You know, for those who don't pray, at least hope that it rains here. Things are very, very serious. If you look at the agenda here, it's going to end just after 1 o'clock, I take it. Is it this, the short day? And we have apologies, we've got the copyright, Treasury, National Credit Regulator, Department of Trade and Industry, etc. Is everyone happy with us? I'm looking at the department as well. Fine. All right. Now, on that particular note, can we have someone to propose the adoption of the agenda? Thank you, Honourable Van Schalkwyk, seconded by the Honourable MacPherson. Apologies, Mr. Medima. Yes. I ought to just put that on silent. We have the Honourable Lord Tlangwini, who's got a family bereavement. The Honourable Alberts will be here. He'll be arriving late, probably 1:30. The Honourable Mantash, I think you're still aware, the bereavement there of her late mother. And then members of the EDD committee were invited, but they're attending their own committee meeting the whole day. And that's why I thought we were meeting the whole day. Right, thank you. Those are the apologies. And let's welcome the DG, Lionel October, Mr. Nyetse Tenzi here, McDonald Nyetse Tenzi, the acting DDG, Consumer and Corporate Regulations, Mr. Sipa Mandla Kumkani, Acting Chief Director, Policy and Legislation, Mr. Kutsa Mahotsi, Credit Law and Policy Unit, Ms. Mishendri Padiachi, is a Deputy Director, DD, CCRD, attending copyright. And then we have the rest here, which I will note as we reach you, because we're starting off with the Consumer Tribunal. That is Professor Joseph Maseko, Executive Chairperson, and Ms. Mara Lees Bosch, Chief Operating Officer. All right. So on that note, I'm looking for a status report on the Copyright Amendment Bill, and I believe what we're going to do here is that either one of the Secretary, Mr. Medima, or the advocate Charmaine van der Merwe, is just going to give us a brief. Where are we with this as we sit here? And interestingly, I met a number of people, I'm sure you have as well, even in the, you know, informal settlements and the like, who seem to have heard that there's something that may help them. And so we shouldn't underestimate the fact that people watch what's going on TV on the parliamentary channel. So over to you, Advocate, and just do that brief overview where we are and some of the challenges we will have to overcome before moving further.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, members. In respect of the copyright amendment, the Beeble, just to bring everyone in the loop in case someone maybe was not here when the decision was taken, there were a number of technical amendments required to the bill where wording was used incorrectly and was clearly not giving the policy intention. So when you read the bill, some of the comments, for instance, received made a lot of noise about some of the terminology, but in fact it was simply incorrect terminology. It wasn't a policy change. So the team in the end became quite large. From trade, we had someone from their drafting team. They also provided us with an expert in drafting, and also then myself, and we've also at some of the meetings had the state law advisor attending, and also of course someone who could advise us, two people who could advise us on the policy direction. So the team has met on five occasions. Most of those were full-day meetings where we sat and drafted. And we actually thought it would go much faster. But as you work through the bill, there's more and more questions that come up. And at this point in time, most of the issues are completed. There are a couple of phrases that we have requested the experts, we have also had two experts of the committee arrange to join us. And these two experts are going to look at a couple of phrases for us. For instance, we have now, the last session that we had, added a definition for open license. And the discussion was whether that differs from public license. And we've crafted a definition so that it reads the way that the bill intends for open license to read. But when the expert did some further research, it transpired that it is a possibility that the two might mean something different. So they are just doing some research for us to make sure that we don't remove the word public license from the bill when actually that was really a word that had to remain and might have serious implications. So in all that we have done, we have not changed the policy of the bill as introduced in any way. Where we felt that something might be policy, we've made a little text box note so that that can be discussed by the committee in respect of policy. The things that are outstanding are, like I'm saying, the experts are looking at some phrases for us where we're just concerned about whether it is the correct meaning, where we might be using two phrases throughout the bill that might have the same meaning so that we can use one phrase instead of two. And then two big changes is in respect of the schedule to align Part A with Part B. It seems that there are, in some of the places, Part A seems to repeat Part B, but it deals with something different. And in other cases, it seems that Part A was adjusted to say the same thing as Part B, but it ended up saying something totally different. So we're just aligning that. So that is the one exercise that we're still busy with. And the second big exercise is to look at the exceptions and to see how we can make, once this bill becomes promulgated as an act, that the act, when it's taken together with this amendment bill, that it reads logically. So that this amendment bill doesn't end up almost making it very difficult to understand what the Act is trying to say. So those are the last two big exercises that we have to do, is to look at the exceptions and the schedule. There are some policy issues we've made groupings, and I think Margo sent that document around to members. Those policy discussions can continue. They're not dependent on the B bill because they are about concepts. So the drafting of the B bill is not hindering the actual policy discussions. That can take place. But I'm hoping that by next week, Tuesday, we'll be able to give, what we've currently done is the bill indicates where we've deleted words and where we've inserted words, but it makes it very difficult to read. So we would like to give members that version so that it's clear where we've deleted and so on. But we would like to give members a clean version almost, so that it's only the things that we've inserted that's in a different color, so that that can, you know, that it's clear to members what we've changed, and so that it just reads easier. If there are still things outstanding, we'll then just pop them into text boxes so that members can at least start having a bill that can be discussed. Thank you.
So, members, you know, this could be for clarity, but it's not to have any deliberation. Is there any need for clarity from anyone? I see, you know, I can't, that's not a member of the committee, is it, down there? No. Did you want to clarify something, Honourable Esterhuizen? You were fine. Was it your hand?
Madam Chair, good morning and thank you. I just think, you know, we've been coming with this bill for quite some time, and the bill, and as the advocate said, you know, the more you read it, different changes come on, and, but we've discussed this in detail for a long time. This bill must not only help the performers, but it must also maintain the industry, and this is what we must look after. We must the amendments in the Copyright Act must not compromise or make it legal for people to abuse original work and even make it lawful to do so. And this is what we must protect, and this is what we in this committee must actually look for.
Totally agree. We do need to ensure a balance. Honourable Van Schalkwyk.
Thank you, Chairperson. I know during our public hearings there's been a lot of concerns raised from different stakeholders in terms of a poorly drafted bill. So I just need to know if those issues that's been mentioned have been taken into consideration. Thank you, Chair.
Very much. And, you know, I do see here the Honourable Tierko is sitting here, and as you can see, the copyright does need to be picked up again, so you do need to look at a schedule which we need to have in front of us for Manco on Wednesday. Something that is tentative perhaps, but some idea, and that should be done in consultation with the advocate so you have a clear understanding as to what remains to be done. And also, is it Mr. Medema or Mr. Hermans who's handling this? Yourself, Mr. Medema. So not this minute, obviously, but find a time so that at Manco you're coming with some ideas as to when we're going to pick this up again. Because you're quite right, you know, the Honourable Esterhuizen, if we leave things too long, we can't have a sell-by date or a shelf life, sure, we accept that. But at the same time, the longer you leave something, the more has to be changed, because nothing stands still, it's dynamic. So we do need to ensure we get our teeth back into this pretty soon. All right, but thank you very much for that overview. Then we've got the presentation by the National Consumer Tribunal on the draft framework on the committee bill dealing with debt relief. You know, we have always had a blanket invitation to members of DTI and the stable, as it were, stable rather than table, that they are here when they see something on the program that affects them. And there's been a lot of issues that affect the company tribunal, and yet, or the national credit one, but you're definitely not here all the time, which worried me. So as you know, we issued a gilt-edged one this time, so I'm glad you're here. Right. Go ahead.
Thank you. present us. I was just greeting the committee, Madam Chair, and thanks for the invitation again for us. It is indeed true that when we look at fellow presentations that will be running parallel with ours, we realize that we definitely had an input to make, not just a listening ear, but a definite participation. Madam Chair, we sent, first of all, the presentation that we are working from the board on yesterday at a given deadline. I think it was just before lunch. And after that, we have since received, we caught glimpses of another presentation, which I think will also come before the committee. It was our hope that we were going to come after other presenters, but it doesn't matter, we are ready, because we have at least seen the major one, which I think we would have to talk to in sort of response. So it means the presentation as we have it on the screen now will be 2 slides short, but we have other information which we've added to the bottom of this presentation, which can be available via email if need be, and we can even copy it now onto a memory stick because it's already in the room with us. But I will just talk to it so far for purposes of what's on the screen. We're looking at the purpose of the proposed debt relief measures that are in this bill. And our submissions are basically going to zero mainly on the aspects that cover the tribunal itself. Yeah. We are not going to comment on the parts that we agree with, many of them in the other parts, but we will go to the ones that, even if we do agree, concern us and actively agree, and then where we have apprehensions, we will be stating those. The inputs, therefore, will commence more around the proposed Section 88C. And if we look at Section 3, if you look at Section 3, the what we call DRAs, these are the debt review applications, debt rearrangement cases that come to the tribunal. These are done on a frequent basis and are for those that come to the tribunal are those for consumers who are experiencing difficulties, but they are not for consumers who are over indebted. The debt counselor whom they approach first evaluates who is over-indebted and who is just experiencing difficulties. Those who are over-indebted, we know that they then go to the magistrate's court if there are agreements and even if there are disputes, and the magistrate decides which way the case will go. But those who are just experiencing difficulties are the ones that the debt counselor gets agreements between them and credit providers, and they end up at the tribunal. So it means for purposes of today, the debt counselor plays a mediation type role between the consumers and the credit providers, because they agree that, look, you are not over indebted, but you are experiencing difficulties. And this is the proposal that comes from the mediated process of the DC. And then the parties, if they agree, then they bring the confirmation, they bring their agreement to the tribunal, which the tribunal doesn't have to take too many presentations on. It just checks it for whether it is correct. Is it something that really we can do? Are the interest rates, for instance, correct? You know, there's nothing in law that is wrong with it. We evaluate it for quality, and then we confirm it. The language of the Act is the tribunal confirms those. And these are the ones that run in the thousands. And these are the ones that we we process through what we call motion court. And these are not defended cases. So you will not have attorneys, advocates fighting over them in the tribunal. And therefore, it would be misleading to the committee if it were to be told that the tribunal is lagging on those. These are the ones that we produce the most prolific judgments on, because we just confirm what they've already agreed. So the mediation process is already built in there, but it's handled by the debt counselor. When it comes to us, it's just to confirm for veracity. And why do we have to confirm? It's just to give it the weight as an order of the tribunal, which means if somebody will be in contempt of that order, eventually then they can be criminally charged. And that's the main thing. The cases that are defended in the tribunal are fewer in number. They are the most expensive to process. They are the ones that cannot have anything to do with debt relief. They are usually cases between, for instance, the regulators and parties, respondents, and vice versa. Those can be just one case and it can take long. We have compiled statistics and financial analysis as to how much on average each one of those costs as compared to a normal debt rearrangement case. Worlds apart. Just to summarize from memory before we may navigate through these slides, I can indicate that the tribunal has itself in our own strategic plan in July 2017 embarked on or inserted the need to approach DTI and approach Parliament through our department to seek amendments to allow an insertion of the mediation clause in our Act. So that, but that is not for the debt rearrangement cases. It would be more for the defended cases, the expensive ones. Because we believe that if we could be able to take a mediation approach like the CCMA does, like the Companies Tribunal does, we might narrow those down sufficiently for the parties, especially if we feel that they just need somebody who can, in a robust manner, take them through the strengths and weaknesses of their cases. You might find that we don't take as long and spend as much money just fighting on the technicalities which they do.
Professor, please, as you were explaining this to us, and you pointed out all the difficult cases, and then what we're looking at here are those people in the country who fall outside and who actually very seldom would have recourse to lawyers. They don't have the funds to do that. So what we want here is for you to address our ring-fenced area.
Sure,
because
sure.
The department itself will be doing a comprehensive amendment of the National Credit Act, but this is not a comprehensive amendment.
Sure.
So if you could tackle the areas where you can see, I don't know if you've received the actual framework, those areas specifically, and if you're telling me now that's where you're going to really be having challenges in some of these, exactly where would you be having challenges in someone who's earning less than 10?
Yeah. No, thanks, Chair. I was distracted by the actual, as I said, other presentations that are coming that we took glimpses of, which...
Professor, please just focus on our framework guidelines, because we've tried to focus on the issue we need to address.
Shall we go to 4? I think 4. Okay. Chair, regarding the proposed section 88B, we can say 4B. It would be required by the NCR to draw the attention of the tribunal to certain findings in the language of the proposed bill. We were sort of looking at that saying, if they play the role of alerting the tribunal, Now, we were looking at maybe we would have to refine as to how, when it comes to the debt relief applications. And it also says they must make a recommendation as envisaged by Section 88.5C. We were looking at, we would need to structure how that recommendation is made, what form would it take. For instance, now it would depend on what sort of role or what sort of power is given to the NCR to be able to do this. We are aware that the debt counselors, for instance, when they play their role, in a way they are representing what the NCR is doing through them. And we were thinking there might have to be another designation of maybe, say, what you might call, for argument's sake, debt relief officers, who would then either be employed or accredited like debt counselors by the same organization, which would then hold them to account to say, for instance, a debt counselor, when it comes to the tribunal, it comes as almost an officer of the tribunal. It must, in other words, mislead. It must, inform in absolute good faith and truthfully and so on. So we think the crafting of that role will be maybe crucial. We have borrowed here from examples like those. I don't know what is...
I can see, and it must be disturbing for you there.
Yeah.
Let's try lifting it up a little bit higher.
Thanks.
I really don't know.
Okay, yeah. So the examples we tried to borrow from, just as quick ideas, was the example, for instance, of a maintenance officer in a magistrate's court. When they do an investigation, they don't have to necessarily bring too many things and evidence to the court. They can just go and research bank accounts and go to employers, interview them, and whatever they find, they bring to the court and say, on the basis of this, you can go ahead and grant so much or not grant so much. So that what they bring becomes prima facie evidence that the court can go with without having to suffer too many hiccups. Yes, but the court must still make that decision. It can't be the maintenance officer making it. But the status of that maintenance officer is so different from an ordinary litigant that they are part of the court itself in terms of the language of the court and how the court sees them. The same thing, you can look at the role of a family advocate. Family advocates also play the same role. They look at the interests of, for instance, the child in that broken down marriage between the parents. And they represent the court in looking at the interests of the child, who can't speak for itself and who cannot rely on any of the parents to speak for it, because they are now partisan, they are fighting, they might fight through the child and all of that. So the family advocate becomes that person who is trusted by the court to say, my finding is this, the family is like this, this is their situation, and based on that, in the interests of the child, I recommend to the court that this be done. It doesn't mean that, again, that word is that final. It just means it produces prima facie evidence that the court can go with and rely upon. But it can still be opposed. If, for instance, the family advocate were to say, these people, they drink 7 days a week and fight 16 hours a day, etc. If that is not true, they can still oppose them by bringing further evidence and so on. But at least as a starting point to fast-track the decisions in favor of the child or in the interest of the child, that family advocate is able to play that role. So we thought if we look at those two types of positions, whoever is going to be the relief, debt relief officer or whatever name we call it, may have to be styled along those lines. So that they are elevated at least. You will not then have formalities that are too many that you have to jump through for the decision to be made.
Okay.
and that when such an individual brings the case to the tribunal and testifies through whatever mechanism, maybe they bring an affidavit or whatever it is that will be finalized, then the tribunal can rely on that. And if there's no violent opposition to it with greater evidence or proof, then the tribunal should be able to make such an order that is applied for and do the pardoning or the relief, whatever it will be in the final terminology. So for now, we just call them designated officers for want of a better word. We noticed that Section 141 already is there to help in cases where a regulator might say, no, we don't think you have a case, we are not going to take it further, that maybe that can still be available to the consumer who will say, no, but I am a qualifying candidate for debt relief. Even if you don't think so, let me rather than take it to the tribunal. They should be able to do that. We think if the provision comes, just like they are able now to bypass by application with leave of the tribunal can follow the same processes which are already there. We think that will bring some bit of balance. Because it doesn't mean that necessarily when a regulator says you don't have a case, you really don't have a case. Mm-hmm. It is their view at that time. Maybe another entity might see it differently. So I think if you allow that space to be available, it would be able to help. In terms of Section 88.5C, next one, the tribunal supports the proposed amendments to Section 90 and 164 to allow the tribunal to declare credit agreements unlawful where, for instance, it is needed. We saw that it's part of the proposed bill. And in terms of this section, the NCR may conclude that a certain credit agreement may constitute reckless lending, etc. And it says then, and may make recommendations to the tribunal for an appropriate declaration. Again, we think that the recommendations, as they are made, depending on how this entity, the debt relief or a designated official, is styled. If they are styled along the lines we were contemplating of a family advocate or maintenance officer, that can be quicker, that can be faster. But as we said, we must still be conscious of that Audi alteram partem, which I know the committee is extremely familiar with, in that if the party against whom the evidence is going has got more overwhelming evidence, they want to persuade the tribunal, they should still have that ability to do so. When it comes to the NCR under Section 5D, subsection rather 5D of 88B5, if they conclude that the consumer qualifies for that once-off debt relief, and makes that recommendation to the tribunal for that once-off debt relief to be granted, then, yeah, we say there should still be room for that conclusion to be sent to the other party. Those who may be saying, no, he isn't. This one, you are lying, he's not indigent and all that kind of thing. He doesn't meet those qualifying requirements. And again, with time frames, which will say, if you don't oppose it by this day, then we take it that it's unopposed, and so on and so forth. Here, we even looked at the fact that this official or designated officer who will bring those applications to the tribunal might have to also be styled along the lines of a consumer protector in a province. Those are the people who receive complaints from the public and process them and issue summons to the different suppliers who are being accused. and then by certain dates, after certain times, allowing them to respond and all of that, they bring the cases to the consumer court in the province. They usually, or all the time basically, where the province has such courts, they are based on provincial legislation, which is subordinate to our national that's produced from this parliament, but it is binding in the entire province where it is applicable. So this consumer protector is free. He provides their services free, like a prosecutor in the criminal court. They, in other words, the consumer who is who needs debt relief doesn't have to pay anything. Even today, as we speak, consumers who can afford to take legal action by themselves still go through these consumer protectors for free, which is what the state has provided to them. And we think if this entity would be able to run along the same lines, it would still help the person who deserves death relief.
Professor, what I think we want to do, because I'm hoping we're going to have another engagement with you, and this is not a one-sort view, see. We want more a focus on the what at this point in time. Because we need to get up to that point so that this can get out to the public, you see. And then we're going to deal with how. And what I'm hearing you focusing on is the how more than the what. But what we want is the what right now. Okay. Thanks.
Yes, it is difficult for us to really be specific enough in that regard. That's why we're throwing several options from which the committee might say we choose this kind of format to move it forward, so that you're looking at the overall picture, because you're only looking at the picture very narrowly from our angle. But I think the committee, when it has had that and other views, then it might be able to channel it even better. Because as I'm pointing these things out, many of them are optional. If you go with this option, you will then style it differently. If you choose another, it might be different from that other one. But it could also be that maybe the committee might want to throw them as they are to the public and see which one is much more popular, etc. But first put them out there, so that by the time you narrow them down to specifics, you are happy that the public has engaged with them. Maybe that could also work. We also agree, 88C, with the suggestion that a single member of the tribunal should consider those matters and utilize the motion court format that we have already utilized and perfected up to this point. Because it's the fastest in one sitting, you process many applications because they are mainly not opposed. And even if they are opposed, it's for quickly determinable within minutes what the opposition is. And you can determine whether that's yes or no immediately. You don't have to first send out summons and call witnesses and cross-examine people and all of that. And then we just indicate that it would require, though, an amendment also to the tribunal rules, which are made in the form of regulations by the minister as subordinate legislation. That can already be blended within the framework in which we process the debt rearrangement agreements.
Right.
Yes. We are thinking that without the need to cover them individually, all the orders proposed under Section 8864 are also supported from our end as they stand. We don't see any problems that might occur actually practicing them. And we throw in one caveat that should the tribunal member who is dealing with it receive such cases, they should avoid going out to investigate and almost do research themselves, but they should handle what is brought before them to remain neutral. Because the temptation in informal situations is that the the one who is determining the matter sometimes ends up just running the show, becoming the prosecutor, the defense, and then also the judge at the same time. So that would possibly be something that would need a clause inserted that says that should actively not happen. But the process should, we believe, remain adversarial in that should anyone want to challenge it, they should still be able to challenge it and exhaust their rights in full in terms of the law and the Constitution. Section 88D...
Professor, what did you say about adversarial? Because I didn't quite see that, hear that, I should say.
Yes.
You've got here, the process must still remain adversarial. That's the last thing we really want, but let me not speak for every committee member.
That doesn't necessarily mean, Chair, that the parties must fight. It just means that they must each still protect their side. If, for instance, the one side still says, no, because remember, when you bring the relief, debt relief, it will not be one credit provider you're dealing with. It might be several of them. Five of them might say, no, it's okay, we don't oppose this. But one of them might still say, we oppose it. And currently, under debt review or in debt counseling cases, the magistrate is then able to hear still all of them, whether you agree or disagree, and still make a ruling. So that is adversarial. Yes. It means even if you fight it out, the judge will still make the call.
Well, we're not going to have established any boxing
ring. We hope not. But it's another option, Chair, that we're throwing out there.
But you need a referee.
Yes, you need a referee. Because even in mediation, the mediator becomes the referee. He's the one who tries to pull you onto one side, but you are on opposite sides. That's always the starting point.
Right.
And then his work is trying to narrow you into agreeing. Section 88D6C. We think if we contrast that with the current existing Section 165, we think the amendment could blend those two. So that, for instance, when the person's circumstances change, the tribunal should be able to rescind or vary that decision that it had made. Currently, if a debt rearrangement consumer situation changes, they are not able to come back to the tribunal and say, hey, that order that you confirmed saying I must now pay little rates, blah, 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 because I was in trouble. I want it now changed to saying, let me go to just being a normal consumer. Because it needs, as it stands already, an amendment. So we think if the debt relief aspect were to be brought in, it would have to provide definitely for the change of the circumstances, and the bill already proposes that. And we think it should not just apply there, but go even to the other side of the debt rearrangement agreement as well. Because it's an excellent one. We were going to be approaching the system to try and amend this, because we're suffering. Right now, many of the people whose circumstances have changed, they apply for these orders issued earlier to be rescinded or to be varied. But we have to say, no, we can't, because we are a creature of statute. Parliament only said to us, you can decide on this basis. We cannot decide on that basis because it's not part of what is it?
We have to let the minister know and he's comprehensive.
Yeah, that's right. And but I'm just thinking that since this will be amending to include, to make this possible, it could run similarly so that under Section 165, the same insertion, it would just be one insertion, which inserts change in circumstances. Because logically, from the street, the people, newspapers, and should I say politicians, when they are not making the laws, they think this is a rubbish sort of arrangement, that I came to you because I said I was in trouble. You made an order which relieves me the trouble. When I come and say I'm no longer in trouble, I no longer want that order, you can't take it away. What's wrong with you? Yes, and the other one is on the general commentary that we would like to make. We observe that the proposal is that, well, we propose that when a single member does whatever he decides on the debt relief aspect, the people involved who come to this process should be able to appeal to a fuller panel of the tribunal, as it is happening already with the debt rearrangement cases, for instance. But as number two, we are conscious that maybe it's because of this thing of being trained to look at both sides, always look at interests of justice, not just one side only, that businesses will be affected by this. We have not had the benefit the committee might have had of researching across the spectrum, across the world, how this impacts businesses. But I think when that business is compelled to, by the tribunal or whatever the entity is, to actually forfeit what is being forgiven, what is being pardoned, relieving that consumer who deserves it, the business is also losing at that same time, because it means they are foregoing what should be coming into them. So I think... with Porsche.
They do carry on.
Because they also exist. We in adjudication like to see businesses and consumers, like you would see maybe the ecology of an economy. If you go to the Kruger Park, you find lions chasing rabbits. The temptation is to only look out for the rabbits because they are helpless. But if you think of the lion, that if you say no more rabbit eating, and then you are saying no more lions, basically, at the same time. Yes, because the businesses eat consumers to survive. And therefore, if you say no more eating of rabbits, then definitely you must also decide you don't want lions anymore. So it looks like the decision you make to extinguish a problem for one creates a problem for the other. So the general interests of justice must then go broader to cover that side, to say what then happens to this business who we are telling pardon this debt. And it's understandable, it's rational, it's legal, because it will be legal by then. But what then happens to that business? So we thought maybe there should be something like, can they get a tax deduction for it from the state?
A
little sweetener, which doesn't kill them off. It keeps them alive, but maybe not as rich as they were going to be if everybody could afford to pay. And maybe there could be some national insurance thing funded by the taxpayer, just thoughts, that they would be able to claim from, we don't know, or anything. But just a consideration would need to be put in that side of it. Because you will find that now internationally, maybe you are attacked by other countries from the investing communities, saying that place is full of poor people, and when they go to their courts crying, you get told to forfeit your money. So you are going to just lose your money in there. You don't want that either. And DTI, because they are the ones that are supposed to be promoting that, I'm sure you would create more problems for them if you don't look after that aspect of it. But that's just in general principles of justice. And Chair, I think... Yes. Yeah, I think that's about it. We can stop here for us. And I don't know if we have to take questions.
Oh, no, certainly. I think there are going to be quite a few, but I see you've got some beautiful offices overlooking the lake, is it? Very beautiful. Must be conducive to a lot of work. But thank you, Professor. You know, you've gone to a lot of trouble. This doesn't reflect the amount of trouble you've gone to. I can see that. Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Thank you. Now, members, it's over to yourselves. I mean, many of you may not share my views. Honourable Esterhazen, who else is there? Honourable McPherson? Anyone else? Right. On those two, going ahead, Honourable Esterhazen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Professor, for his presentation. I also, the same as with the previous item, we, I think, you know, this has been also going on long, and we hammer on the same things. The lady on the left here, this young lady here right in front of me, like most on her presentation, answered most of the things that I always complained or not complained about or raised as concerns about. But still, you know, in the financial climate that we are now, people are driven, have feelings of anxiety, and they are driven more and more every day to more desperate measures and very expensive money, like overdrafts and things which they really can't afford, and other people. And on this presentation, also, you know, there's already measures built in, there's already legislation, there's the Audi alteram rule, or listening to the other side, doesn't really matter if there's legislation for forbidding them, not forbidding them, but preventing the banks. There's already this 3-year death that they can write death off. And my concern is also not so much the short-term thing, but in the long-term, in writing death, or there might be other things and knock-offs. If we allow death to be written off and freer, this will very much increase the bank's chances and ability to recoup their costs, and this will only increase the cost and carry it over to the lenders and make it more expensive. And banks are also very much in the banks put interest on interest on interest, even as they do this. And at the end of the day, it's still unfortunately to this unrealistic debt repayment that the poor are still subsidizing the rich. And that's my concern, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Honourable Esterhazen, Honourable McPherson.
Thanks, Chair. I think it's important from the outset, and at some point we're going to have to do it as an exercise, about what happens from the point of someone going to the NCR, making an application, and to its full determination. Because I don't know how much communication has taken place between the NCT and the NCR, and just from the presentation, it doesn't seem like a great deal. Because, I mean, I would disagree with you where you suggest that the NCR should play a role similar to a family advocate or a maintenance officer. Their job, as the bill would propose, would purely to look at the application on the papers and then refer it to you. That is where their job would end, as I understand. And then it's at that point really that the NCT has to then adjudicate that application. Now, I agree with Advocate van der Merwe that it should be done on a motion type process. But the problem with the NCT, the way that it is structured and that it is is a quasi-judicial body, is that that is always going to require legal representation. Whether you like it or not, if a lender opposes the matter or arrives at the hearing, they will be entitled to arrive with legal representation. And the applicant would then not have legal representation, and the matter would then have to be deferred. And the advocate has mentioned that, you know, the theory behind it would be to try and get through, you know, sort of hundreds, which means that you'd have hundreds of lawyers lining up, you know, in the corridors, and you'd have to create a new seating facility just for them, hopefully with views overlooking the lake as well, which would only further delay the process. Now, I've mentioned, and I'm going to mention it again, and I know that it's not something that you guys are happy with, but I really think that when we deal with this, it's got to be dealt with in a CCMA-type process, where whoever is adjudicating it looks at it purely on the papers and makes a finding. If either party is not happy with the finding, they can then take it on review. But in order for that to happen, it would require a dispensation to be granted or the NCT to be reconstituted and redefined to deal with that particular area. Because I'm not suggesting that when you're dealing with cases like BMW and Edcon, that should just purely be done on the papers. And so I think that I'd like to hear your views on that particular point. I've expressed previously that I'm not comfortable with a single person adjudicating this, just because it broadens the margin of error for bad decisions to be taken by one particular person or by that particular person. And I think that there needs to be a broader scope for adjudication, whether it's two or three people, so that there is greater fairness built into the adjudication process. And then I think the big question that exists is around capacity and funding as well. What is this going to cost, and who is going to pick up this cost? So I would like your thoughts around that particular point as well. And you know, I think your job as the NCT is to protect the consumer. And so I'm a bit sort of taken back by your general comments under point two. So I'm not sure why you thought you needed to add that in. To be honest, I'm not sure that that's relevant. It's on page 13. You're fighting for the consumer, not the producer. So I'm not sure why you did that, but you don't have to answer. It's not a question. It's just an odd inclusion. So I'd look forward to hearing from you on those questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable McPherson, Honourable Williams.
Thank you, Chair. I think that this presentation is putting the cart before the horse. We haven't even got the final understanding of what this bill or amendment will look like, and you're going on about how you're going to implement it. So it's a little bit premature, the presentation. You didn't say a lot about, you know, the actual content of the bill itself. I'm also a bit concerned by why you were defending the credit providers. I mean, it sounds like they lobbied you and came here, and you've been lobbied by them, and that's not very good. So I'm a bit concerned about your whole presentation, because it seemed to me that you're just looking for powers on how we're going to implement the legislation. So that's a bit caught before the horse, and I don't feel that your presentation is actually helping us at the moment. Thank you, Chippers.
Thank you very much, Honourable Williams. You know, as I said before, we were looking at the what here. What is helpful is that you've actually specified what you're commenting on, and that is helpful, thank you. But and one or two you know, sort of innovative approaches or something like a debt relief officer, which presumably could check the tick box form. But, you know, I'm just saying that is an innovation there. What one worries about, though, here is, where did I see it here? It was, yes, I even raised it. It does worry me. I know exactly that all courts, if you like, are adversarial in nature. I mean, that's, I imagine, because we're under still under Roman Dutch law. That's still what we're using, you know. You know, we all know how adversarial that law is. But let's get away from, you know, that side of it. And to, I'm a bit concerned when you, as Honourable Williams is saying, you're focusing more on how we will implement this. And although you acknowledge that a motion process would be the fastest, but then it would appear as if the rules would have to be amended. And we are actually trying to produce an act eventually, the committee bill, it's not coming from the department and so on, that will be rather swift, like a sort of military or sailing corvette, as it were. And we're not looking at powers, unless it's essential, you know, that we can't move without that. And we've made this clear to the minister that we would see this as being part of his comprehensive look at things. I have no doubt, you know, powers will need to be looked at when the minister is having a look at things. But the other one here, I think the Honourable Macpherson has really gone into the one on the credit provider issue, and so has Honourable Williams. But you see, issue of rabbits and lions. Now, you know, it may just be terminology and examples, but it does indicate that, well, our guys are the rabbits, aren't they? And that's exactly who they are. That's why they may not be getting justice, because they are just little rabbits running around. And I think that that's a great, it's unfortunate that they may be seen as such in terms of the example you give. And I really want to suggest your point about someone must be getting something back. There must be some balance. I didn't see balance in that particular manner. And maybe you could tell me how that works. Because if you look at the Constitution here, which I was looking at, with respect to things like dignity, equality, and all of this, and fairness, it's very clear that if you treat someone without dignity, don't expect something back, except perhaps a penalty. So you need to respect the terms of our Constitution, and we believe that this bill here is within the spirit of the Constitution. It's not intended to help me. It's intended to help those who are earning less than 10, as I understood the drafting framework of this bill. So if you could comment on that rather than how we're going to achieve it eventually, that would be very helpful. Thank you.
Can I
Yes, professor. But I'm sure you're used to this. You know, you're a professor.
No. we have to deal even with parties all the time. The senior council fighting, sometimes they can take even hours killing a mosquito with bazookas, because that's how they have to make their point. And we still have to navigate through and understand it. I can just try to go back to the questions that seemed to attract, I was writing now. Okay, yeah. The issue, I think, from Honourable Macpherson about family advocates and maintenance officers, that was just an attempt from our part to think aloud, to say, how would you approach it in order to expedite it? And to me, these are the typical formats in which things get expedited. But as I said earlier, even then, you will find somebody who will still take that decision on review or appeal at a higher court. because they might still claim that there's something you missed or you misrepresented. So that's where you find that even if you make a law, it will not stop them from those rights that they will have. They will still bypass it. In other words, you might find that you're speeding things up at the bottom assisting, but you chalk up the system, the justice system going up. And when those with the money start taking these matters up, the ones without the money suffer more, because these appeals will tend to override and they can no longer come to represent themselves there. So it means while we are trying to solve the problem, we mustn't make it look too unfair to those that are affected by it, because they start using the money that they have and to do exactly more of what we are trying to get rid of. That is basically it. We've not been lobbied by anyone. We ourselves didn't know we were coming until, I think, last week, when we had to furiously read the bill for purposes of now coming to present and try to have a meaningful presentation. Nobody would even be able to approach us because of the nature of our work. We don't even entertain correspondence as tribunal members from the public. Anything that comes in the form of correspondence, whether it's a phone call, a letter, a complaint, it goes through the administration. We forbid our tribunal members from talking to the public or newspapers or anyone for that specific reason. The use of a single member, we were thinking that mediation is necessarily a neutral thing. When you mediate, you don't necessarily rule. You don't judge. You assist the parties. You conciliate. It's what they call conciliation. So you're trying to just broker a deal between the two sides so that they all save time, save legal costs, and settle the matter. It's almost an out-of-court settlement. That's what mediation seeks to do. And it would then be, in our view, the spirit of what the committee is wishing to do. That to prevent people from fighting it out using facts and the law, they just get someone to harmonize them and assist them to see their cases differently and end up striking a deal, saying, look, even if you want to fight this through, you want to go through to the highest court, by the time you finish there, but where will your business be? Because that's the only way you conscientize them. If you don't sit down to do that and mediate, they fight it out and lose all of them in the process. Because basically litigation loses everybody. It only benefits the lawyers. But we understand the unhappiness with a single member. At times, if we can use, again, borrow the CCMA model, if the CCMA, for instance, where I have worked, I think, with our DD here for many years, you sometimes can allocate even a fuller panel of more than two or three people to a mediation because you want them to assist in even small focus groups, because it's an informal process. Yes. It's not where you judge, it's where you can broker the deals between the people. You can even see them separately and rove between the two or ten groups if there are many. And that's how it is handled. So it doesn't really, it's not too critical for us. When we were saying a single member, we were saying it so that it solves these efficiencies. One member mentioned the possibility of hundreds of lawyers because now there are hundreds of cases. If you have only one member dealing with maybe five, six cases per day because they are mediating in them, you can solve that problem. The other thing is in terms of capacity, which has also been mentioned, I think, by Honorable McPherson as well. The tribunal has just almost doubled the number of members that it has had. Currently, with the members that are there, we have even reduced them going to motion court because we find that the death counselors are not bringing in as many cases as we hope they would, because we have introduced an IT system which enables them to process those through the computer. And therefore, they have slowed down on going to motion court, trying to fit the system through the computer, which will be more efficient for everybody. So with that, I think capacity will not be a problem. But again, that would be putting the cart before the horse, because we don't know how many people would be undergoing debt relief, how many applications will come, we would just still be speculating, which currently everything else is speculation. Yes, the appeal process we were suggesting should be put in for those who are still not satisfied with whatever might have happened with that single member, etc. But for more difficult cases, we know that you might have to still assemble a bigger team just to deal with that case. Chair, you mentioned the spirit of the Constitution, and my reference to adversarial. All that it meant there, I know it probably triggers bad memories and all of that. Sorry for the unfortunate use of examples, but we use them to try to illustrate a point. So if we can not focus too much on them, but focus on what they are trying to point at. Like if I pointed the slide, if we can focus at what is on the slide rather than on the finger itself, because it might distract because of these unfortunate examples. We are looking there at saying, that these people will be bringing different interests. That's when it is adversarial. That is when we do not want to say the one who is now assisting them takes over the case from them, because then it becomes your case, and it might bring a solution they don't want. But if you focus still on what they want and mediate that or adjudicate that without generating your own case on the side, which means it should be different from running with the Commission of Inquiry, because that starts with an open-ended slate which says, let's find out what the problem is generally and then solve it in our own way. But this would be saying, let's try and say, what is your problem? What is your problem? How do we solve these two? How do we fine-tune your problems? Not a third one that we have maybe generated ourselves. It is in that regard that we're saying. It shouldn't be inquisitorial to that extent of trying to generate the problem yourself, but rather solve the one from the parties. I hope that was a number of things.
Well, I think, Prof, you know, this has been your first input here, and as I said earlier, we would hope that you will follow this, either, with the documents being sent to you, but also perhaps with engagement for those who do attend on a more regular basis. I know the National Credit Regulator comes fairly regularly to these meetings, just so that at the next point you could add to, in fact, where you did more of a focus today is where we would want you to come in again. But thank you very much, and we would like then to change over and ask Ms. Catherine Gibson to join us from National Treasury. Thank you very much, Ms. Gibson. And have you got the professor's details?
Okay. Agenda? You next.
affidavit.
Thank you very much. Sorry, I just had to shift around. I'm a bit short. Couldn't get it over the speaker. Okay, well, thank you very much for having us here again today. I just to recall, we were here last week and we briefly gave some inputs. So this is then an extension and a follow-on from that. Apologize for the presentation getting to you later yesterday evening. Although I'll confess up front, I have made a few more tweaks, but it generally is the same. We are perfectionists, after all. Okay, so given the nature of a lot of the discussion that's been happening, we thought that we wouldn't just respond on the proposals themselves, but actually just take a step back as well. And the reason being is because a number of issues have been highlighted over the course of the last few months now. And from our side, I think it's useful just to take stock of how we've got to where we are, and in particular to confirm, I think, what it is that we are wanting to achieve. And why I'm highlighting this is because my understanding is that at its heart, the committee is looking at the most indigenous, the indigents. I think some of our concerns is that we might be losing focus in terms of, rather than saying these people are really suffering and they're suffering today, and what is the most seamless, streamlined way we can reach these people, we continue to discuss that, and then the conversation seems to evolve into multiple other areas which at times can maybe take us away from that. I think also just to highlight that, of course, from our perspective, from a financial sector policy perspective, any intervention has to be balanced in terms of financial sector policy objectives. I think this goes out without saying, and the point has been made that what we are looking is to relieve really strained households, but in a way which is sustainable and doesn't lead to unintended consequences. Just to put in the context that I think it needs to be, it might be obvious, but just to state, we're not coming here thinking we have all the answers. In fact, it's more recognition that this is such a complex issue that it seems that as we move forward, it just raises a lot more questions. These are just some of the issues that we're wanting to keep in mind, the engagement on the level of the write-off, maximum level of debt. The one that I want to highlight, and it seems that we still haven't got an answer here, is the focus is very much currently still on credit providers. You are obviously relevant to all of this, but actually our experience is that it's the debt collectors, and particularly the attorneys who are debt collectors, who are holding a lot of this debt and are sitting largely outside of the regulatory net altogether. And so if we are only looking at credit providers and we do not look at the debt collectors, we will be missing arguably one of the more significant hurtful places in this market. And just to be clear, I'm not saying that all debt collection is bad. Many debt collection has a very important role, but at the moment the regulatory framework is not protecting consumers. So some of the issues that have been previously raised within this forum relates to the role of the Credit Act, and we mustn't be forgetting that, of course, the debt relief is wider than the extinguishing. And in fact, the proposals, some of the reforms that are proposed to the Credit Act itself will be instrumental in making sure that we protect protect South Africans on a sustainable and ongoing basis. The other crucial point here relates to debt counselling and how to repair debt counselling in a way that it can be used optimally and most effectively for consumers. And that's not just for the upper income, but even for how far down can we stretch the debt counselling system, because it's conceptually it's a good notion. It's a way of empowering consumers to take responsibility and sustainably rehabilitate. The debt collection I've spoken about, the point to note, and we will get to this as well, is that debt relief will not come without cost. It will provide a crucial lifeline, but there will be costs. And so what is imperative for us is to understand what those costs will be and who will most be affected. Yes. Sure. The next slide is one which we presented on before, and in fact a number of these issues that we of course have raised before. This slide is really, it's a combination of measures being taken by, largely by the DTI and the credit regulator, together also with the financial sector regulators and ourselves. And it just reminds us that the issue on the table must not be seen in isolation. The question for us then is, to the extent that these interventions are happening, we must be particularly vigilant to monitor the impact and effect of these. Are they being effective? Have we done enough? What still needs to change? And of course, these are still, a number of them are still in implementation, and the DTI has already voiced, you know, its plan to be doing an assessment and evaluation of these various interventions in due course. The reason why I'm saying this is because, again, this must be our caution of recognizing that the debt relief measures are fall within a spectrum. Am I going the wrong way? So I think the next point for us is one that, well, the next couple of slides go to what it is that we're trying to achieve. And I think from our side it would be very useful for the committee to agree on a set of principles, because those principles can really then be used as the scope or as the parameter within which any of your decisions that you make regarding the measures and the implementation of those measures can be guided. So we have flagged a couple here that we have spoken about, the opportunity for a fresh start, changing borrowing behavior, which is not to say that these are necessarily the right ones. They're just ideas of what it would be that we're trying to achieve. So we've also going on in terms of the different solutions for different categories. If a person can pay, he or she should pay. Promoting responsible lending, promoting responsible borrowing. And I think just to, as an aside, the member from the tribunal had spoken in the Lion Hair example. I think we need to be very cautious as well about understanding what our respective roles are. The roles of us as government or as Treasury, we are from our side, we are balancing financial sector policy objectives, the role of the tribunal is a court, is not a consumer advocacy body. It's necessary that it must be balanced and it must be fair. That's not to say that it's consumer protection isn't critical, and it's not to say that there aren't abuses which must be taken up. But again, these rights, it's appropriate that they are balanced. A lot of the discussion had been around the extinguishing of debt applying to unsecured loans. And I think this is an interesting one because, again, this goes to the principle of, if we look at this and we look at the principle as well around that if you can afford to pay, you should pay, and if we understand that there are different mechanisms, so if someone has an asset, they can sell that asset, they can pay their debt. However, having said that, there's also the next principle which we had spoken around, which is protecting the borrower's asset to the extent possible. And these principles are important to think about because it's these principles which ultimately are going to need to be balanced in terms of identifying what the final measurements are. So if we consider then, for example, one of the issues of the definition of a realizable asset as it's currently being presented, it does in fact include a motor vehicle. There's questions around whether there can be questions around whether that's appropriate or not. I'm not presenting a view. It just these kinds of things need to be teased out within the principle framework. And then, of course, the role of doing a comprehensive impact assessment at each and every stage that the decision-making happens. The evidence of the past interventions, I think, is a useful reminder as well. And where we got to was to say, approximately, and this was in relation to the cleanup of the credit bureau data, and this evidence might be contestable because, in fact, we're wanting to revisit it to see whether how reliable this is because the Bureau subsequently has cleaned off that data, so we're needing to, by requirement. But having said that, on the results we have, approximately half of the beneficiaries remained in the clear. So now I'm not sure whether that's a good thing or whether it's a bad thing. It's good that at least 50% remained in the clear, but what happened to the rest? And the question then we have to ask ourselves was this good enough? Was it good enough that only half the people remained in the clear after that intervention? And the reason why we have to ask that question is because we need to know what lessons to learn in order to not replicate the same mistakes. Maybe mistake's a strong word, but how can we improve on that result? I mean, what we'd be wanting to see, the best case scenario is 100% of the people remain rehabilitated. Obviously, maybe that's too high or impossible, but I think that we need to think about how can we keep people rehabilitated. So some initial thoughts on the draft bill. Of course, and this is what we had spoken about last week as well, is the importance of these comments that you see now will ultimately be substantiated and informed by the research. We do have some questions on the bill just relating to its approach and intention. So the first of those is if we can agree what the principles are, or if at least the committee agrees what its principles are, does the bill satisfy those effectively? There's a broader question around the appropriateness of this being an amendment bill to the Credit Act as opposed to a standalone bill. This is driven in part by, again, the question around the debt collectors and the need to reach the debt collectors and whether this is something which on the debt collectors specifically, is this where does the committee intend to reach debt collectors and how can we bring debt collectors into this process? The related question is the role of the committee in terms of the extinguishing versus the broader Credit Act reform and whether there's a need to differentiate, and I'm asking that on the grounds of the rights or the powers being given to the minister in terms of debt relief. And there's a question of, given that there's a broader reform process, should those specific provisions not be considered within the broader reform that has to happen for the Credit Act? And then what is the role of the Minister of Finance and the Governor with respect to the banks and systemically important financial institutions in particular, given the concurrent jurisdiction, well, the call it concurrent jurisdiction? So looking in specifically at the current proposals, I think the reference to indigent and child-headed households, if we consider the principles and as they've been implied through the committee hearing, seems sensible. It's also consistent with the view that that those above the 300,500 could perhaps access another reform process. Just to highlight, our 10,000 rand figure, which was referenced, was an early approximation. And I think having, as a, with further engagement, and in fact what's come through the committee, it does seem like the 7,500 rand is probably the more reliable. So please, and this will be again confirmed through the study as we go forward. I think it's sensible as well that we're taking into the account the principle of no realizable asset, given that that's the flip side to dealing with leaners. But then, as I've already raised, then the definition of no realizable asset seems to contradict that in terms of allowing for the protection of a vehicle. Again, that might be justified on the basis of we needing to protect, you know, the income, if we can call it that, of these people. I'm not sure. Again, it just seems to be something that we probably need to think about a bit more, and we'll have more questions going forward. Something I'd raised last week was on the person categories, and how do you? So in principle, we say that this is an indigent person or it's a child-headed household. But it will be useful to find the most easy way of actually identifying those categories. So besides the definition of that's been included, it would be useful to have almost immediate markers of someone who's indigent. So for example, someone who is a SASSA beneficiary, by definition, could be classified as falling within this category, because you've got a clear marker. That person either is a SASSA beneficiary or they're not. It's not something you then are having to prove in any way that they qualify within the category. And there might be other ways of categorizing as well. The reference to the affordability criteria. Currently, the affordability criteria, and again, this would be useful for the committee to talk to experts and people involved in the market itself. But at the moment, it's seeming the affordability criteria are complicated. And what that means is it potentially is allowing people, the way that the credit providers are using the affordability criteria, lending to people who maybe should not be actually lent to. Now, the question with that is if we are saying, so I think the example I'd given is that in some cases, people within these categories are being lent up to, with interest repayments of up to 70% of their income. Now, I know there will be arguments as to why that happened. There might be a joint household income or other. But the reality is I'm sure a lot of those people actually should not be getting loans, given that the affordability that seems to be presenting itself, but again, hopefully our research will give more concrete backing to this, is that people can actually only afford, particularly in the lowest income categories, around 20%. And so what that means is, in terms of the assessment of what's affordable and what's not, it might be better just to actually put in something far more simple to apply. Maybe even it's a case of saying 20% of your income coming through, or 25%, whatever the level might be. The value of the debt to write off, it's hard to give an input in this stage because we don't actually have the information. We don't know how much debt this category has, who's holding it, who will be impacted. So my sense is that until we actually have more information, it's hard to say whether it's 10,000 rand or 20,000 rand, because of the impact on both sides is just an unknown. What we can say is that actually the
the debt-to-income ratio for the lowest income categories on the evidence that we had from the 2013 study was actually quite low compared to, for example, the upper income or the above 15,000 rand per income band, largely on the case that those people were holding secured assets. So the moment you've got a house, obviously your debt-to-income ratio is going to be a lot higher. I mean, just adding to that point, I think which a feature which shouldn't be forgotten or overlooked, and again, this is something we're wanting to interrogate further, is actually debt counselling, when it's working, works well. And that actually most people who are coming into the debt counselling process from what's been communicated to us, in terms of the debt they have, can be effectively processed through the debt counselling process. So it's not as though people are coming in with such volumes of debt that they can't affordably get through the debt counselling process. On the applications and orders, some questions, and again, this goes to, I think, your point that you were making, that this is maybe the next step for the committee to be moving into when it gets, once it's gone through the what, as it were. There are obvious capacity questions, and I think this would largely be, the question is what capacity, we don't even know what capacity would be needed right now because you don't know how many people would be affected and how many you're trying to process. Proof of income, there is an obvious incentive to mislead on your income, and so there, again, perhaps has to be, or we could think about how to support quite an easy verification of those facts, be it through the banks or through, I mean, the other issue that's relevant here is whether you have an insurance policy or not and the extent of that insurance policy. The valuation criteria given in 88B makes sense. Agreed that there should be flexibility in the granting of orders. The challenge, of course, is balancing the flexibility with administrative burden and how to make that it as seamless and systematic as possible. There is a question on the prescribed periods for halting, which can be seen in two ways. So, on the one hand, it seems to me a fair thing that you're not just writing off the debt or extinguishing the debt immediately; that you're actually providing for stepping stones to get to that. But having said that, I am also conscious that there are regulatory implications on that. So the moment you park a debt, then it becomes, and I'm not an expert on this, it's a question mark, there will be implications to how much capital has to be held against that. And so it becomes expensive. And so this is something which you would need to engage the banks on as to the time periods and what's workable and what's not workable. And the issue is that if it's impacting the banks, it likely, this holding of capital, as it were, for the non-banks, they don't have the same regulatory requirements, but it's still expensive to keep things parked. The likes of the retailers or the microfinanciers would need to answer on that. And we strongly support the need for prescribed rehabilitation periods. So if you are entering into and you do get relief of some description, that's a serious thing. And we need to then, supporting the principle of trying to correct borrower behavior and learn new behaviors, teaching to save over consumption spending. These are important mechanisms. I think the question for us is how can we even further support that changing of behavior, but those are nuances. And I also like the fact that there was a staggered rehabilitation as well, that if you opted for the lighter regime, then you would have a lighter implication, which again is creating the right incentives. So just some other considerations. I mean, we are nearing the end here. The question is on timing, and I know that there is if we can call it a pressure, there are a lot of South Africans who are under this hugely damaging strain. Oh, sorry, this is a... No. Did I not?
Oh, no.
Oh, sorry, I might have added this.
All right.
Okay, please excuse me.
What we'll do...
We'll carry on, but we will get the slide, all right? But you, some of you have got it. Oh, no. Oh, all right. There's a new one. Do go ahead, Ms. Gibson. Okay. Thank you. My apologies, Chair.
Well, that shows members are actually following you. I mean, it's a very good sign.
Hang on to these. We are going to get what we haven't got now. Can we leave it there? Do proceed, Ms. Gibson.
So the issue on timing is around how to balance what is arguably this urgent, powerful action, but at the same time against recklessness. And I think there have been a number of issues raised around we needing to move forward as quickly as possible, and that's right, but we'll just need to make sure that when we move forward, we're very clear about what it is that is going to happen as a result. The amendment on Section 69, keeping register of applications, this generally is captured. I think this goes along with the principle of the bill, which does support the keeping of information. And why that's important is to make sure that this information is kept over time, so that whether it's through the Bureau or the credit regulator, so that the effectiveness can be monitored on an ongoing basis. There's a question we have around how many times can you apply potentially for debt relief. Particularly, and these questions around timing and also the application of debt relief come in because this is a once-off debt relief for the committee, but what's being proposed is what potentially are multiple extinguishing processes which could follow. There are some concerns with the prescribed debt relief provisions, particularly the open-endedness. And I know that there is, I think, an attempt to try and close this and make it open-ended, if I can use that phrase. But from our side, it still does seem to be remarkably open-ended, and also not with the same checks and balances which seem to have been built in so strongly for, you know, in terms of the committee process. We do then have the question marks over the role of the committee in this regard, and whether in fact that given the significant impact of extinguishing debt, that it should perhaps require the approval of the committee, that any of these steps should require the approval of the committee. And then, of course, what is the role of our Minister of Finance and the Governor, in particular relating to banks and SIFIs? So, for example, when we deal with insurance matters or insurance, I mean, as has come through this committee, there's been a concurrent jurisdiction given and joint approval. The Induplin rule, I think that there has been an interest in here, and I think the DTI and credit regulator are probably best placed to talk about this. From our side, what we've seen, and I'd come and spoken about the EAO project where we had, and one of the biggest challenges is that there's not certainty over given all the different fees that can be charged from when the credit provider initially offers the loan to how that loan is collected on, particularly when that debt has been unsold, and the various fees that can be charged, and the fact that there's no boundary to those fees, that it should be made clear that, in fact, it applies across that whole cycle, that whole chain. Or maybe even just to be more, I mean, you could either apply the Induplin rule or just apply a straight cap across the whole thing. That's not just a total cost of credit cap, that's a total cost of credit across its life cap. And then the process of engagement, which I think is which has been adopted, goes through the research, concrete proposals to build on what's already been presented here, impact assessment, and then I expect that there would be further hearings based on the specifics of that. In conclusion, then, the framework bill is useful for us to start thinking about our matters of principle and what principles can be confirmed. As we've said, the details of coverage of debt relief and impact should be informed by the research that's going to be coming through. Debt collectors
should definitely be included here. We've raised here this question around municipalities because a lot of the debt is sitting with municipalities. And this relates also to the sales and execution. Because in many, there have been instances of abuse there. But in some of these instances that are reported in the media, often those auction prices, what they don't tell you is that what they actually, why they land up going so low is because the person who takes on that house or the property actually has to make good on its municipality liability first. No, but that's new. Sorry, that's very new. So historically, that was what was happening. That's only come through very, very, very recently, to the relief of everybody. Related to that, I think there has also been questions raised on the sales and execution process. So it would be probably a good idea to have an in-depth session even on sales and execution, because I know there are a lot of concerns, both from the credit side and general financial consumer protection side. And then looking to the medium to long term, how can we avoid getting into a cycle of extinguishing debt? We don't want to be coming back repeatedly. And the reason why this is being highlighted is because that broader reform of the Credit Act and Credit Review, Credit Regulator, should be accelerated in line also with the Insolvency Act. And I think just a parting reflection is that what we are really needing to get better at is our research capability within our regulators. And this is a priority within the new, as we're setting up Twin Peaks and looking towards a new Financial Sector Conduct Authority. And what's been clear from even the process we've been going through now is we just haven't had enough real-time information to help in the responding to a number of these issues. Research is expensive, but if we're going to have good regulators, it must be prioritized.
Thank you very much, Ms. Gibson. What we're going to do to save on time is to have the National Credit Regulator now, and then we'll do the questions after that presentation to both National Treasury as well as the NCR. So if the National Credit Regulator could come up. I think we've got is that right? Yes. Now, because you have been here on many occasions now, Ms. Machigari, you know, we hope that you'll be able, as someone who's been here so frequently, to be able to do this for us in 15 minutes, this input, and then respond in the questions to the longer issues. Right. We're all there. Well, where's Mum that was here? Got DT on there. No. But where's Mum? Right, shall we start? And as I said, it can be fleshed out in the responses. So welcome to you, and that is Ms. Nomsa Machigari, the Chief Executive Officer, the Deputy, it is the Deputy Chief Executive Officer, Mr. Obed Tongwani, and then is Ms. Tupang Ngabeni here, the Senior Legal Advisor. Right, okay, do go ahead.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members, the DG and other officials from the DTI. The purpose of this presentation is to provide inputs to the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry regarding the framework for the NCA Amendment Bill on debt relief. Now, we are obviously in support of what the bill proposes in terms of potential beneficiaries of debt relief. And these are your child-headed households and indigent consumers. But in our, in terms of our experience, there's also the missing gap, which may somewhat also have been, you know, covered in the bill. But these include consumers who don't qualify for debt review. They don't qualify because their income is very low. Okay. We may look at the situation where a fund is put aside to be able to subsidize these consumers. And obviously we'll have to put in, you know, a very strict criteria for those people who would, you know, qualify to be subsidized for debt relief. And we also have consumers who qualify for debt review, but whose debt repayments do not solve through the debt cancelling rule system. These are consumers who have taken on too much debt. They may not necessarily have a low income, but because of the huge number of credit agreements that they have, you know, to repay, you find that it's very difficult. Even in instances where you lower the interest rates to zero, you find that, you know, they are unable, you know, to repay their debt. So those are the two categories that, you know, we have identified. These are debt cancellers who don't qualify for debt review, and then you also have those that are, you know, in insolvency. So the ones in between would be those two categories. Now, we are suggesting that because we know that, you know, you have instances where people, even if they make good on the debt that they have, they are, we will always have those consumers who are faced with circumstances that are beyond their control. And we want to say that in the long run, perhaps we should look at some of these debt relief measures to be, you know, permanent. But we would have to make sure that in implementing these measures that are being proposed now, that we do an impact assessment once the implementation has been done, so that we don't always have to come back, you know, to say, can we change the act to accommodate people that are suddenly facing difficulties in, you know, repaying their debt. So in the long run, I think we should try and find measures that can, you know, continue to be permanent to redress, to provide redress to consumers who are over indebted. But we'd have to be very careful. There have to really be very strict conditions, you know, and criteria built around that. Now, causes of consumer over indebtedness are ever changing. And in consultation with credit industry, we can provide timeous redress by agreeing on and implementing rules to be followed when combating over-indebtedness. And we propose that any agreed-upon rules between credit industry and the NCR should have a binding effect and be enforceable, you know, such as the debt rule, you know, the debt cancelling rule system. Currently, this system is an initiative by industry. But for us to be able to make this work, it will have to be made oblique. You know, we have to force it on every credit provider to use it. Currently, we have a challenge in the sense that not all credit providers support it because it is not in the act. And we keep getting challenges, especially from the debt counseling fraternity. And in terms of the Prescription Act of 1968, a debt becomes extinguished and falls away in that debt remains unpaid after the lapse of a certain period of time. 3 years for any debt, 15 years for a debt owed to the state, and 30 years for debt that is secured by a mortgage bond. And we propose that an additional measure of debt relief, credit providers must be required to conduct a once-off audit of the debtor's book in order to determine and expunge any debt that has prescribed. So we have to force this on credit providers. I'm almost tempted to say this must be done on an annual basis whenever an audit is conducted, so that prescribed debt must be identified. And this is a this will go a long way in relieving consumers. And in terms of Induplum, we propose that the Department of Trade, Industry and Department of Justice and Constitutional Development cooperate to review the current legal framework on Induplum. There are some interpretation issues around this, and therefore I think we need to clarify, you know, what costs can be included in Induplum. Now, obviously, unlawful charges such as, you know, your club fees as well as reckless lending are some of the causes of consumer over-indebtedness. And protracted litigation is resulting in the continuation of these, you know, unlawful practices. Whenever we identify reckless loans, we have to refer this matter to the National Consumer Tribunal. And obviously, what happens is that the practice continues, you know, until a ruling is made. So we are suggesting that even though the Honorable Chairperson has said amendment of the Act should lie with, you know, the Department of Trade and Industry, that NCR should be given powers to at least suspend any alleged unlawful fees as well as reckless lending pending the finalization of any litigation. And this will provide a disincentive, you know, to trading providers, you know, in continuing to provide these unlawful charges to consumers. They'll have to think twice before they start extending reckless loans. I thank you, Chair.
I wish they were thinking twice already, of course. But thank you very much, Chief Executive Officer Machagari. Now, Ms. Gibson, you also have to be ready there. You know, got your mics, haven't you, and so on. So this is what we're doing is we're going to field some questions and have an engagement with both institutions, National Treasury as well as the National Credit Regulator. Are we? But so indicate where your question is directed. Honourable Williams, Honourable Kachalia, Honourable MacPherson, Honourable Van Skalkwyk, Honourable Esterhazen, in that order as right, and Honourable Tierko. Right. So if you would start, Honourable William.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, all of my comments and questions will be directed at the National Treasury. Firstly, I just want to say last week we were told in this committee that National Treasury had attempted to influence the Parliamentary Law Advisor, and this is completely unacceptable. There was some lobbying taking place, and we'd like to encourage National Treasury to lobby us directly and don't go to the people writing the legislation for us. Also, I'm a little bit concerned about the presentation from National Treasury. First of all, there's a word COM there. What is the responsibility of the COM? I don't know what that means. Is that the Portfolio Committee? And if so, perhaps you should write our name fully. Also, I'd like to say on slide 14, there's a bullet point there that says debt collectors must be included. I'm a little bit concerned by the attitude of National Treasury towards this bill. It seems that they're trying to steer the direction of this bill, and things like putting debt collectors must be included is a little bit arrogant of National Treasury, even though they have a good point, and yes, I think that debt collectors must be should be included as well, but I think that there should be... I don't feel that their presentation was trying to assist us, but rather trying to direct us in a certain direction, and I feel that it's a little bit inappropriate of them. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Williams. Honourable Kachalia.
My questions and comments will also be to National Treasury and take a slightly different view from my Honourable colleague here who just spoke. I'd like to say that thank National Treasury for highlighting certain issues which we and concerns which we share, particularly in terms of balance, which I think is terribly important. I'm also aware that you're working on aspects of quantification, and there's some that I and this might be teaching grandmother how to suck eggs, but please take it from whence it comes. aspects which would be of interest to me particularly. One would be the financial impact of categories of relief on various categories of providers and the implications for ongoing credit provision in that regard, because I think that's crucial. Then, and I don't know whether this falls within your remit, but some development of mechanism for tracking the impact, the ongoing impact, the financial ongoing impact on recipients of relief. And then in terms of municipalities, what is the role envisaged and what are the cost implications and the scope and quantum for debt transfer then to paying consumers? Because I think that's terribly important as well in terms of balance. And then any other ideas in terms of costed carrot and stick measures to effect behavioral change. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Kacharia. Honourable MacPherson.
Thanks, Chairperson. I think both National Treasury and the National Credit Regulator spoke to the point that I've been trying to make for some time, that extinguishing debt is just one aspect of debt relief. And I think that we are so focused on that point that we're missing all the other opportunities for debt relief. And I think that...
MacPherson, my mind wandered then. Just repeat that.
I said that I think that we're so hung up on the idea of debt relief, extinguishing as a form of debt relief, that we're missing the many other opportunities that exist for debt relief in its entirety. And that's because we simply don't know who we're speaking to, and I'm going to keep making that point until I actually know who I'm speaking to, Ms. Gibson, and it's not your fault, but until such time as we get that research that says who is indigent, what do we consider to be indigent? Because quite frankly, I can't consider someone who earns 10,000 rand a month as indigent. I just don't think that is correct to do so. And it's what I said last week, is that we start to get into this bidding war of you say six, I say seven, trying to work out who we actually should be focused on. So I think the sooner that we can get that, it would be absolutely necessary. Now it goes to the big question of, well, should this be a standalone measure, or should we be looking at the reform process in the NCA? And now I've long advocated, Chair, that there needs to be reform of the NCA in its whole bill, and not just one particular aspect of debt relief. Because if we don't take the opportunity, and I know we keep being told that the DTR is going to bring, some amendments to the NCA, but, you know, that could be until 2019. We just don't know, because we're at their mercy instead of us actually driving the process. And I really want to encourage us to look at reform of the National Credit Act in its entirety and not just around this particular issue. With the affordability criteria and looking at simple measuring opportunities like a percentage of salary, I think that's a really a good suggestion, and I'd like to see some more thought around that particular issue. And with regards to, if we go to, municipalities, I don't know why we want to focus on, credit providers, but not, government entities. And it seems to me, quite frankly, hypocritical to say, and I said this last week, and I'll say it again, that we only want to focus on the private sector, extends debt, but we don't want to focus on government sectors that do the same thing. If we're going to have one rule, it must apply to all. that find themselves in that situation. And then the big question is you know, maintaining records. And, you know, how do we, you know, how do we actually ensure that that people that go through this process, we have a record of that. We have a record of what do they earn, what asset do they have or not have. And for me, it's one of the biggest unknowns as to how we're actually going to record this process from day one to year five after they've been through a rehabilitation process. And so I'm still not clear around that, and I'm not sure if the National Treasury or NCR have any process to do that. And then with regards to page 9 of the NCR's presentation, I mean, that's one of the biggest things that I've been speaking to the CEO about, is the power to suspend credit agreements you know, until such time as it's finalized. And also dealing with reckless lending. Now, that is a form of debt relief, but it's something that we want to park to another, you know, to another year. And so I would hope and encourage, or would like to find out some information from the NCR. Are they making representations to the DTI? Have they put concrete proposals around what needs to be amended in the NCA to see these sorts of things take place, and where they are in that process?
Thank you. I didn't want to interrupt you, Honourable McPherson, but I think I must make the point that when the committee took a decision that it would wanted a bill for debt relief, it was initially called Debt Forgiveness Move to Debt Relief. It was made very clear to Parliament, the National Assembly section, that this is specifically what we intended to achieve. This is why we are here, to request X. It was very clear that we weren't looking at a comprehensive amendment of the Act. And it was on that basis that we were given permission to proceed. And so we cannot forget this wasn't an individual member's bill. It was a committee bill that all parties agreed to. It was unanimously adopted. That is what we want. I'd be the first to agree with you, Honourable McPherson, that the National Credit Act requires a comprehensive amendment. I'd be the first, but that we know is going to take a fair amount of time, and we identified this as one of the critical areas, and therefore it was ring-fenced. So, but I didn't want to interrupt you in the middle. Let me allow, no, let's not have a response. Was it yourself, Honourable Van Schalkwyk?
Thank you, Chairperson. When I look at slide 6 of the National Treasury, the first line, it says, first, we want to, in terms of the vision, we want to give South Africans that are chronically over-indebted and have no chance or way to escape their debt the opportunity of the fresh start. And I think that's the crux of this intention that we are having. And I think when we've already spoken lengthily in terms of this term of indigent, and I think we've agreed that the term indigent falls amongst others, will be the term indigent, but we won't only focus on people who's indigent. But also, Chair, when we look at the issue of when we look at page 9 of the presentation, it speak about the 600,000 consumers as a sampling that was taken, even though there's no real data available in terms of who were the beneficiaries of the 2007 Credit Bureau clean-up. My concern is when we speak about the sampling of the 600,000. 600,000 out of how many? Even if we don't have the real data in terms of who were the beneficiaries, can we at least have some indication of how many people benefited through that initiative? So that when we speak about 52%, we must put it into context to say that the 52% that we are talking about is 52% of the 600,000 and not the 52% of the total number of people that we spoke who took advantage of that. And also I wanted to speak in terms of page 15 on that issue of the debt collectors that we should also include. But yet again, we must remember that this is a committee bill, and we accept all the, we value all the inputs and advice that's been taken to, given to us, but we don't want to be some kind of in a position where we feel that we are being intimidated to look at a certain opinion and be directed that we must do this and we should do this. And what. It should be our own discretion based on the facts that's been presented on how we move forward in terms of this. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honourable Van Schalkwyk. Honourable Oosterhuizen.
Thank you, Chair. I'll just start with my little note on the Treasury's on page 4 in very bold, big letters, debt counselling is failing. And it is failing. People are taking advantage of debt counselling. And a good example is the furniture industry sector. We tend to have 50% non-performing loans. And the difference is that those who pay are charged higher interest to make their businesses profitable. Nearly 50% of South Africa debt is expensive, unsecured credit on short term. And South Africans are spending 98% of their income, or most South Africans, on their income and debt repayments. And this is one hell of a mountain to climb for this committee and for this sector to get out of this. And on the same page, it was agreed that need for relief must be balanced against the... And that's just coming back to Professor Maseko's presentation as well, where he said that consumers is not only in favor of the consumers, and I say that as well. There must be a balance here. Financial institutions, banks, are already building in protection against bad loans and things. And this is also protecting the lender is also protecting the consumer. If you look after the lender, you're also protecting the consumer. So we must look at that as well. Next, page 6, I've just said affordability assessment not done. Page 9, 60% of individuals who benefit from an SD. It's worrying that statistics show that South Africa are over indebted, owing around 1.6 trillion rand to lenders. This is really... a very big concern. Page 12, does the NCR tribunal have the capacity? They surely have the power. They can cancel the registrations of a credit provider or excessive lenders. I think they do have the power. And on the very last place, the in Dublin rule. You know, I just used the furniture industry, and it very much it happens, especially in that, not only in that, even in the, that people pay more than double what the interest is in these industries, what the inductance rule means. And just then to the NCR, on their last page, the NCR should be giving the powers to suspend. The NCR does have the powers. They does have the powers to cancel the registration. And they must use it. We must not forget that the NCR still has the shame of the African bank lending practices that hangs over them. And they must use the authority for this and protect the consumers. And I think that's it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Oosterhuizen. Honourable Tierke.
Mm. Cheers, thanks. The purpose of us doing this process is for us to make sure that the poor of the poorest are assisted on the ground. We are doing this because we want to assist the poor of the poorest. But I've got the feeling that the treasury, like, I don't know, there's this thing of, like, protecting even the service provider. She's just touching, but you can feel that she's protecting someone. It's my opinion, I don't know. Because when you go to page 4, last week we received presentation from the, to say debt counseling is doing well so far. Though we identified the problem where it is, because how do you pay while you are poor? I don't know how to put it, but we have identified there's a problem. That's why we are coming with an intervention of the relief of this committee bill. However, on I've got many, page 9 of the treasure. It says the affordability, which goes hand in hand with the NCR, when it talks about the groups. Which groups are we talking about here? So if by today we're still asking ourselves questions, we are not assisting the process to be finalized, then it means there's a delay somewhere, somehow. Someone is trying to delay the process now. Because I'm saying, you are agreeing with us on the 7.5 to say you think it's affordable and realized. Those are things that we need to hear in the committee to say, here you are coming okay. Here we think you need to adjust here so that we move forward and assist the poor of the poorest on the ground. Speaking here on the boardroom, speaking these big languages, people are, the debts are piling up on the poor of the poorest on the ground. So we are speaking this English, big English, but those people are not assisted on the ground. That's my feeling. I don't know. Page 13. Yes, Chair. Is it 13? Yeah. These amendments, and it goes hand in hand also with page 7 of the NCR to say we are amending here the register. I hear the NCR say we must have an ongoing the monitoring process. I don't know how we need to know the people that we have assisted. You are saying you have assisted people on the bureau, credit bureau. Those people, it's not the same people that are in debt now, currently, as we're speaking. We are putting an intervention, and you came up with a question to say there are people who were assisted, but we don't even know by today those people who are affected now again is the same people who were affected then on that system. We are putting system in place, acts in place, but we are not implementing what is supposed to be implemented on the ground. We will keep on amending, but we are not implementing our own policy, our own act on the ground. I think that's my input, Chair.
I'm allowing Honourable Williams just to come in here. He is, after all, the chairperson of the subcommittee focusing on debt relief. Just quickly then, Honourable Williams.
Thank you, Chair. Chairperson, I think it's important that everybody in this room should remember that South Africa is an over-indebted country because our credit providers continue to provide credit to the consumers, and now we've got 1.6 billion trillion rand worth of indebted society. And now credit providers caused this situation, and because they could have said no to many of these applications, and thus are responsible. And there seems to be a trend where we're trying to move away from credit providers taking responsibility for the crisis that we're in this country. For instance, if the bathroom was flooded, we would turn the tap off, would be the first thing to do. You know, we wouldn't just keep bailing out the bathroom. So I think that we really need to not allocate blame, but the people that need to pay for it are the people that caused this problem. Secondly, I just want to mention one more thing to the National Treasury, now that we're on such good terms. National Treasury said that their figure of 10,000 Rand was just an approximation at the time. Are there any other figures that National Treasury would like to tell us are not relevant to our work? Because it really caused problems for us last week, because that figure was used when we were debating the actual bill. And we actually put that 10,000 Rand in the bill now, sitting there. Now you're saying that that's not a reliable figure. So maybe in future, please don't send us unreliable figures. Thank you.
All right. Now, I did see your hand up, Honourable MacPherson, but you'd already had 6 minutes, dear. You may come back. You may come back, but let us allow everyone. No, really, I allowed Honourable MacPherson. He is the chair of that subcommittee. Now, come on. You can come back after we've had the responses. I've made that clear. Now, who is going to come in first? On Ms. Gibson. Honourable MacPherson, is Mr. Williams the chair of the subcommittee or not? Yes, it does. Thank you. Welcome to leave if you wish. Ms. Gibson?
Thank you, Chair. So I think I should... Honourable Member Williams did start, and he did raise... I mean, before we get into the technical matters, I should firstly apologise profusely if I have presented any view that I am... doing something untoward. That's very definitely not the intention or the case. The engagement that I understand was referred to with the advocate was very much, I mean, as we try and do with all our work, understand the basis of what is being presented to the fullest extent so that we can properly inform our response. In terms of what has been presented as an arrogance of the reference to MUST and the reference to committee and not portfolio committee of trade and industry, it was an oversight on the reference. I'll make very sure it references appropriately in future. The MUST was unintentionally arrogant, if that's the word. I think that our experience with debt collection, particularly through that EAR process, has been disturbing. And so that MUST was not meant as an instruction by any means which of a parliamentary committee, of any parliamentary official who by vote is independent, and we really respect that independence and clarity. Relating on the data, I think the 10,000 Rand figure, it was necessary to correct. We had over that was, I think, the earlier stages of our engagement. We've had a number of engagements since then, and in fact, over the course of that engagement, we ourselves have referenced the 7,500 Rand debt busters figure through our own course of our engagement. So very much when we stand to be corrected, we rather would be transparent and correct ourselves, and it hasn't been left, I don't think it's been left until this late time. But again, my apologies. Getting then to the technical matters, and sorry, just on the debt collectors, but just to make clear, by holding the debt, wanting to ensure that the debt collectors are included in here is not saying that the credit providers should not, and that should not be held responsible. Obviously, there is a balance of responsibility here as well. Looking then onto some of the more technical matters then, Honourable Member Kachalia, there was concerns on getting the balance right, mentioned the financial, the impact, and of course that's going to be coming through through the research. From a government perspective, we obviously are conflicted in terms of municipalities because there's a big fiscal impact there. So I think there is a cautionary as well around the extent to which the municipalities themselves can be, in fact, brought into this process. And that would have to be very sensitively and cautiously followed as well. we take the point about the I suppose the benefit, the cost or the stick cost, the incentives and stick measures. I think that the this has been something which has been on our minds about, and I know that the credit regulator is sensitive to it as well, about how to get cooperative coordination of be it credit providers and or debt collectors as may be appropriate. I think often we look to the stick first, and that's not to say that there aren't times when it's necessary. But to the extent that we can get cooperation or a coordinated response, sometimes you can reach a big group all at once. I mean, so to use an example, we previously engaged the life industry, the long-term savings sector, long-term insurance sector, on what was a statement of intent, and basically the industry came forward to say, we acknowledge we've been charging too many fees relating to causal event charges, and actually as an industry, we will agree, even though it's within our rights, within the law, we'll agree to cut those charges over time. Has had a massive consumer benefit, and in fact we're looking to build on that as well. The question around who is indigent and the you know, wanting to avoid the bidding war scenario, I think what's important here is, and I mean there was another question related to whether we, you know, needing, why are we not giving guidance on the different, or why are we not being more clear on who we think should be captured in this net. And firstly, I think this goes back to the principles again. We can't just, it's probably unwise to be trying to just pick a number, as opposed to understand what are the principles guiding why are you picking that number. And so one approach that we've been guided by has been, to the extent that there is another mechanism or an availability of another mechanism, which is why the debt counselling is so critical, the reform of the debt counselling is so critical within this landscape, is because what we know from on the balance of the information is that below 3,500 is indigent. Basically, that's the extreme, the poorest of the poor. And so very definitely we would want to capture and relieve the pressures for those households. We then are informed, although again the research is needing to support this, and so even the current figures will need advisement on by the research, will be between 7,500 or upwards of 7,500. Debt counselling is cost-effective, it makes sense cost-wise, and so there's still the gap that the credit regulator had referred to. And so the question is then a matter of principle. Which way do you go for that gap? You can either extend your debt relief up to fill it, or you try and bring those people and you think, well, that's a short-term measure and it's immediate and it's a one-off thing. Or you think, well, we're looking to have a sustainable, long-term, ongoing solution, therefore we need to actually get debt counselling to work for those people in the lower income categories as well, and the question would then be how, because it has to be funded somewhere. So that then, it's that gap, I think that middle gap, which is particularly interesting. And of course those two are not mutually exclusive either. I mean, it could be a case of there's a once-off relief of extinguishing, but over time debt counselling is considered how to anchor down, or somewhere in between. On the affordability criteria is something which we I think all collectively we're needing to think about more. The recording of data, I think this is not just around who records data over, and it's a common theme around who records the members who or consumers who have been into debt relief, but there's also the needing to make sure that the integrity of the process is right, which means we're needing to make sure we've got good data on approximately income levels and asset levels, which raises another question around how to get that verification done in the most seamless, non-controversial, uncontentious way. I think Honourable Member von Skalkwyk, again, about the debt collectors and the must, and I have covered this. Again, it's it's not meant to unduly. I mean, I think in an open and a transparent environment, I don't think that I can be unduly persuading, which are clearly very independent and independently minded committee members. And I mean, I think what can be said is that it's important that these are transparent processes, and that the integrity of the process as a whole is upheld. As I said, the debt collector story, though, it's so frustrating when you, I mean, I suppose from your side as well, but, you know, from our side, when we've been sitting here and it's with this legislation and protection across so many different areas of the credit universe, and yet there's these one group, this group of people, and literally, I mean, within our experience on the EAO study, it's you know, narrowed down, and it's not a reflection on all debt collectors, but there are probably the top five, or maybe not even that many, are accounting for chronic abuses. And so there will be a lot of people who should get help and won't get help if we omit to look at the debt collectors. On the debt counselling, there was references to the debt counselling side where I'd spoken about it failing. Just to be clear, that our response there was that wasn't represented as a National Treasury view. Actually, over the course of these hearings, or over the course of these meetings, there have been a number of concerns raised relating to debt counselling. And over some of those sessions, some of the committee members have been visibly concerned, would be, and at some times upset about how the debt counting system has not met up with how it possibly could be working. And the reason why I was raising it is because it's important that we don't then look to the extinguishing of debt as to be the solution for everything just because we think that the other mechanisms are not working effectively. It's more a case of recognizing this is a good system at its heart, which actually has done a lot of good. And if there are shortcomings, we need to then focus on managing those shortcomings and repairing those shortcomings. And then going back to my, you know, the previous point around how can we extend the debt counselling down to reach down to help those of the lower income levels that currently it can't solve. And I know that, I mean, it might in some instances it's purely a computer exercise that it just can't solve below a certain income. But there is a more substantive issue relating to the fees charged of debt counsellors, which does raise its questions as well. There was a last point on the reference to the Credit Bureau and the information there. And that very definitely the people we're talking about now are not necessarily the same people who were involved in the credit data, on the cleanup of the credit data process. I think the point, though, is that when we are stepping in quite an interventionist way to help consumers, what we're wanting to be sure about is that we sustainably rehabilitate those people. And we don't want a case where a household gets the relief today, but because of either lending patterns or borrowing patterns, which might be problematic on both sides or either side, that the person then gets committed, you know, in 6 months to a year to 2 years' time, because it's a dangerous scenario to be thinking that the extinguishing of debt becomes the solution. Might be a solution at a particular point of time, but actually it's a dangerous solution if it becomes the only solution we have to managing over-indebtedness.
Thank you, Ms. Gibson. The National Credit Regulator.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. There was also a question around maintenance of records. And yes, Section 69 of the Act does provide for, you know, establishment of the Register of Credit Agreements. For us to be, and it would be, you know, a perfect register to be able, you know, to register, you know, applications for debt relief, amongst other things.
but unfortunately it would, it would require a lot of funding. We did conduct a business plan. We did a business plan some 4 years ago, and at the time it was going to cost us $5 million just to set up the register. So, yeah, it's something that is provided for. It would require the minister to call for it, but it would also require funding, you know, extensive funding to establish it. But it would be a perfect tool to use to record information of this nature and to even track it, you know, monitor it over time. Just to go back to Honorable Ilse's question or comment around the fact that NCR does have the powers to cancel registrants' registration. We don't have those powers. Once we have identified contraventions, we would normally, we refer these matters to the National Consumer Tribunal. And it's only the National Consumer Tribunal that has those powers to cancel the registration of a registrant or impose a fine, you know, on a registrant. And, yeah, there are a number of other things that they can do. But certainly NCR does not have those powers. Just a point of clarification there. Yeah, that was it.
Honourable members, I, you know, although we're running a bit late, as I said earlier to the Honourable MacPherson, he wanted to say something. Now that there have been the responses, please come in.
Thank you very much. I think it's very simplistic to say that the reason why we haven't over-indebted this problem is because of credit providers. And if one looks at the NCA and the affordability assessments, those are very, very strict assessments that have to be put in place for people to get credit. Now, if people are receiving credit without the affordability assessments being done properly, that then is reckless credit. And that must then be dealt with, and it must be extinguished. But we don't want to talk about that, and that's what I don't get. So we keep saying that the reason why we have in debt problems is because of credit providers. But if credit providers are working to the law, then that is legal credit. That is legal credit. That's a fact of life. If they are doing it incorrectly, then we must declare it, or the NCR must declare it reckless, and it must be extinguished. But we don't want to talk about reckless credit now. We only want to deal with indebtedness. And that's why it's actually intrinsically linked. And for the life of me, I can't get to grips. I can't get an explanation why we don't want to look at indebtedness in its entirety. Why don't we want to deal with club fees? Why don't we want to deal with reckless lending? Why don't we want to deal with illegal credit lending, which nobody wants to talk about? We only want to deal with lending that is done by registered credit providers. Not once in this process have we discussed about illegal credit. And so I think we need to be very, very circumspect with how we actually look at this issue. We need to understand who we are speaking to. What are the versions of debt relief that we can offer? What is the purpose of what we are trying to do? And how do we actually work with the credit industry to make a credit industry that is strong, resilient, and allows people to move up the value chain, so to speak? But I think we must, I just don't think to say that the reason why we're in a particular issue is because of the credit industry. People have a choice to get credit or not get credit. You know, people are desperate because the economy is so bad that they have no other option to look after themselves. No one wants to talk about that particular issue.
Let's just conclude. You know, Honourable MacPherson, I think many members sitting alongside you do share some of those views. But I come back to this. Perhaps within the committee itself, without the presentation and inputs of institutions and the department, etc., perhaps the committee itself needs to deliberate a little bit more on that, so that we ourselves are agreed on what it is we want. Those who are here with us today, for example, Treasury, DTI, National Credit Regulator, and the Consumer Tribunal. Can we leave it there for the moment? It does not mean we have resolved it. I think I need to make that clear. But time is absolutely not on our side. It is now 11:45, and we have to hear DTI. We really do. So what we do have, I understand, I'm looking at yourself, is it Cynthia? Cynthia has been, as it were, linked to us or whatever, seconded to us for a short while to assist us. So is the tea ready? It is. Can we have a running tea break, please? But I'll give you 5 minutes just to, you know, to grab, and then if you want any food or anything else, I think let's do it like that. So it's 11:45 now. 5 minutes to get out, comfort break, grab something if you're desperate, or wait a little bit.